Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. After a week of snow and ice, massive power outages, and Donald Trump's second impeachment trial, how do we move ahead to implement the progressive agenda so many of us are craving? While we wait to see and how to influence what comes from Washington, D.C., there is a lot to advocate for at the state and local level. Today, we talk with Oregon State Representative Karen Power, who represents District 41, about some bills she's introducing to address our biggest concerns right now: COVID, the climate, and taking care of children's needs. Karen, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's good to see you.
It's been quite a couple of weeks here. I'm thinking the last time that we talked was right at the beginning of the pandemic. And I think we talked a lot about just how disorienting the whole thing was and all the fears we have and the difficult reality we're trying to adjust to. We're about 11 months after that. Do you think that reality has gotten more used to this reality, or do you think it just keeps getting stranger and stranger?
I think most of us have adjusted, and it feels like it was forever ago that we used to get together in restaurants and at parks in large groups. And I miss dinner parties. I miss having friends over inside my house for dinner and being able to sit down and be warm and have food and share potlucks. That was one of my old favorite things to do with friends on a weekend. How about you?
Yeah, we just made a big fish stew last night, and we've been talking to two of our friends who are over 75 along with my wife, because we're trying to get COVID shots. So we'd been having conversations with both of them, and as we were making this stew, my partner said, "Oh, I just wish we could have them over for dinner." But I'm also thinking about the series of crises that we've experienced since last March, and I wonder, particularly as a state representative, how you manage these crises and how you deal with your constituents as they're going through, for instance, horrific things like the wildfires in the fall, which a good part of your district was actually under a level one evacuation order back in September. How has that informed and transformed your role as a state representative?
Well, I know that we have a shortage of mental health counselors or people who have capacity to take on additional clients at this time. And I really think the way this is impacting people physiologically, as we're becoming much more sedentary and can't get together, and I think we're probably a little luckier than in other locations in Oregon that we don't usually have extreme weather and we can still get outside year round. You know, it's been one thing after the next all year. And in the backdrop of political violence for a lot of people was, I think, a breaking point for stress levels. And to me, it seems like any small disruption in sort of the things that enable you to have a sense of normalcy, like power, like internet, those things that are incredibly imperative when we can't actually get together, is having a, you know, just a disproportionately large impact on people, understandably so.
How would you feel right now if you were a state representative in Texas, especially as your senator is slipping off to Cancun?
In our previous lives, when we could travel, I got to meet some state representatives and colleagues who were newly elected in Texas. It's not just their deregulation of power that's the underlying problem. It's that they didn't weatherize any of their systems. So they have an incredible redundancy. I know they're blaming it on renewables right now, but their natural gas plants had to come offline because they couldn't withstand the cold. But I don't know how you plan as a state representative for areas that have 100 degree temperature swings over the course of a year, and how you plan for redundancy in a system to manage those kind of extreme temperatures. It's incredibly daunting.
Just before we started to record, I was mentioning to you the three themes for today's show, which are based on emails that you send out as a state representative to your constituents, and I am one of those constituents, and so I receive your emails. And it seemed to me that three issues that you're focusing on in this year's session are COVID, climate, and the needs of children. So let's talk a little bit about climate. And it also seems like these three needs are all very much interconnected. But we are experiencing some swings of weather that I think all of us would say we can't remember in our own lifetimes, or maybe even our grandparents' lifetimes. And we are really now in the throes of climate chaos. And they're certainly experiencing that in Texas. And so you're talking about the need for resiliency and redundancy in our energy infrastructure. But how do we go forward in grabbing the climate chaos bull by its horns and changing our practices now that can actually stop exacerbating climate change? And what are you planning on doing as a legislator this session?
Gosh, well, that's a great open-ended question. So listeners might remember that I worked on the cap and trade bill for the last 2.5 years. And when the governor's executive order was issued, our state agencies are moving ahead with work within their rulemaking purview that are really going to make a difference. And so I want to give you a couple examples. Department of Energy is working on energy efficiency standards for appliances that'll be among the best in class. Department of Transportation is forming, I think, a new climate office. And the doubling of clean fuels, which is blending more renewable or biofuels with existing petroleum fuels, really helps to lower our greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. Oregon's a little different than other states. You know, a good chunk of our energy comes from renewable or hydro sources. And looking at where we need to go from here, it's really tackling our transportation sector. So I had asked to join both of the transportation committees, and I'm hoping to bring a climate lens to that work as we're talking about congestion pricing in the region and how it works differently than tolling.
Let's talk about what congestion pricing is versus tolling. What is congestion pricing and why is that maybe more effective than tolling?
Well, and I don't want to lose sight of like the bigger picture climate work that we need to do, which is decarbonizing in all sectors, moving to electric vehicles where we can, and moving to renewable diesel or other types of freight movement that is less greenhouse gas intensive. So we've got a lot to do there. But back to sort of our regional needs. We've been growing rapidly. You know, it still seems like hopefully there will be a steady influx of people into the Portland metropolitan area because that's sort of the backbone of our state. And how we move goods and services and people is important. So in 2017, the state legislature authorized some big mega projects in the region, but also greenlit congestion pricing. And it's different than tolling. Tolling is you hop on and you pay a fee to use the road. We have fees to use roads already embedded in our gas taxes and our vehicle registration fees, you know, things that kind of help pay for our current infrastructure and new infrastructure. Congestion pricing would be different than sort of a flat toll. And it's designed to incentivize people to think about traveling differently during peak congestion price, you know, periods. So we know there's a lot of single car traffic as people are going to work, going shopping, whereas it used to be busy on our roads from 8, you know, to 9:30 as people are going to their work and then coming home. Periods of congestion are beginning to expand beyond that. And it's not just a Portland metropolitan region area. We're seeing congestion in other parts of the state as those areas are growing rapidly. So congestion pricing is a variable fee. And maybe you pay a little bit more during those busy times. And maybe you think about delaying that non-essential trip. Or instead of hopping on a freeway, you might choose to take transit or carpool or
bike,
walk. I mean, if you can, or frankly, not use highways as throughways.
How do you pay for that? Are you going to have a little gadget on your dashboard?
Yeah. So I grew up in New Jersey. So these things are not intimidating to me. I mean, I grew up getting my driver's license, hopping on the Garden State Parkway and throwing my quarter into the basket because everything was cash. Now, most multi-state pricing programs are linked up together so that you have, if you buy a transponder for your car and it goes pretty much right underneath your rearview mirror, it links to your bank account or it can link to just a invoicing program. And it's linked to your car and your license plate. So that way you don't have to slow down because that actually did cause more congestion as people are backing up to get in through a fee pricing structure. Now you can drive through at 40 to 45 miles an hour, 50 or 55. If you're on the East Coast, nobody stops anyway. You just go straight through.
Now, it seems like there's a little bit of Big Brother there. People are upset about these tracking programs on your phone to track if you've been exposed to COVID, and they don't like that violation of privacy. But it sounds like these transponders are letting the government know where you are at every moment whenever you're in your car.
Well, only if you're using the system. But, you know, red light cameras are in most, I mean, they're scattered across the country, and the police use cameras for you know, speeding infractions from time to time. So I think it's part and parcel. You know, the DMV has us linked up to our cars anyway to know who gets a ticket. And this just enables you to go faster without having to slow down. And it helps especially for people who don't have cash on them. There's usually still a cash option in case people who don't have one on their car.
So it means like if you get onto 405 in Northwest Portland, that this transponder would then let DMV and your bank account and other places know that you're driving the stretch of road when it's the congestion period. And so there's automatically going to be a fee that's going to be assessed.
If I remember talking to my dad, who has one on all of our cars back east, I don't know if it links you to a particular location, but it's like getting a charge, you know, kind of like swiping your debit card or your credit card, right? It knows how much that's going to be on in the system as you're moving through and what that's going to cost.
Now, do you feel like you're going to get some buy-in from your constituents about this? Do you think that your constituents might be a little bit uneasy because it seems so different from the way we do things here in Oregon?
Oh, my goodness. People have strong feelings on both sides, as you might imagine. I think broadly, people who work in land use, environmental advocacy, conservation, understand that congestion pricing is a proven method globally to help manage traffic demand. And if they are hoping to not see us build out additional freeways for capacity, then congestion pricing can help kind of manage that. It would be new here. When I moved out here, it blew my mind that you can cross any bridge and you don't have to pay any money.
Well, until you get out to the Bridge of the Gods.
They do. But, I mean, you can drive all around the Portland metropolitan area. And it's not free because we pay for it in gas taxes, but in our vehicle registration fees and others. But it's... We're currently untold, unpriced, and any kind of big shift like that, there'll be strong feelings about it on both sides.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today, we're talking with Oregon State Representative Karen Power, who represents District 41, about some bills she's introducing to address our biggest concerns right now, which seem to be COVID, the climate, and taking care of children's needs. And right now, we're talking about some climate issues. Well, besides congestion pricing, I understand that you are behind a bill that would mandate that all land use regulations in the state have climate impacts attached to them. And I've heard about that from some climate activists, actually, who are very excited about the bill. So I wanted to talk about what that is and how that would work.
Oh, I'd love to. And I'll just put a kind of bow on our conversation around congestion pricing and tolling. It is already in state law to move forward with congestion pricing. Right now, I think ODOT's engaging in a broader stakeholder conversation because they'd like to just have tolling authority. And how those two programs are different is important to discuss broadly. And people have really been leaning into that. So moving away from how we sort of manage our transportation emissions for the moment, as a former city councilor, you know, who is involved early on in land use decisions, who gets a seat at the table and who is even thought of was readily apparent to me because I love folks who can show up and volunteer and come to meetings. But we know that disproportionately skews to people who have time, access to get there, and don't have obligations at home or at work that keep them busy. And most meetings are in the evenings, usually. And I know City of Milwaukee, for example, just started providing full translation services and childcare services pre-COVID so that we could get more people to engage. But the reason why I brought this bill on behalf of a broad coalition, Beyond Toxics, NAACP of Eugene Springfield, there are many others leaning into it, are so many of our minute land use decisions have an impact on climate change. You know, if we're developing a particular parcel and taking away stormwater absorption capacity and increasing runoff, maybe to the nearest stream or creek, that's going to get worse as we're seeing heavier rainfall events. And so those little decisions in the aggregate become really important. And not centering people who are disproportionately affected by climate change is an error we've made in the past. And I don't think is equitable for us to continue to make. So I know that the advocates are actively working to assess what's financially feasible right now. But there are broad goals within that bill that I think are very exciting.
Well, in some ways, it's kind of a no-brainer that land use has big impacts on climate change. Yeah, actually, I did a radio documentary a number of years ago where I was trying to show that land use actually impacted climate change, and I couldn't really prove it, and I couldn't get anybody to agree with that. So we wound up talking about learning how to live with these big changes and figure out ways to be resilient. I don't know if you could prove that building this big complex is going to induce more climate change, but certainly things like increasing carbon emissions, which some of these projects do, that's going to impact climate change. And then when you take away the ability, as you were describing, for water to drain where it should like to drain, instead it's going to drain in somebody's basement, that that's not dealing well with the impacts of climate change. So let's break those two things apart. And are there parts of your bill which actually would mandate that new construction or any new land use changes must really look at how they impact climate change as well as how they might affect our ability to deal with climate change?
I have colleagues who are working on a REACH building code to help incentivize more energy efficient new construction. This bill doesn't prescribe particular, you know, construction standards. I know that that is how we retrofit what we currently have, how we make things more energy efficient going forward, would address a huge part of climate emissions. Because the way that we use energy inside of our homes, especially right now, and within buildings, is a major contributor. This would center impacted communities and disadvantaged communities within decision making, require local governments to consult with entities as they're making plans, create a process by which climate change would be a lens that you'd be looking at land use decisions through. And some of it, frankly, is a bit big for this session. But I know that the governor's recommended budget proposed some money to help sync up the way that we view climate or land use decisions through a climate change lens. And our advocates are working with state agencies right now to sort of sequence this bill and come up with an amendment that helps, I think, Oregon to continue being a leader in land use planning and preparing for a more resilient future.
Well, I'm going to give you some of my wish list for some future legislation, maybe hopefully in the near future, because they're working on this in Washington right now, Washington State, to end using frack gas in heating and cooling and other infrastructure for a new building, and starting out with city buildings, government buildings, but I think moving down the line to including residential buildings and all commercial buildings. And this is something that a lot of people are championing, that we really need to move away from frack gas. And I have to say, after being without power for a couple days this week, I really appreciated my gas water heater, my gas stove, and my gas radiant heater. So it's a funny kind of contradiction to find myself in. But I still understand that frack gas is really a major contributor to climate change. So do you think there's a way that we can actually start to mandate that in Oregon and to really start to move away from frack gas as the means of heating and cooling future construction?
Well, I think where some of our major cities lead, states often follow. And so like you mentioned in Seattle, when they're looking to ban fracked gas in new hookups in new construction, that is a powerful signal to utilities that they're going to need to diversify and then plan for a future where that is not their purpose. So here, you know, closer to home, I know so many people who have been able to stay in their homes thanks to having a gas fireplace that they've been able to keep themselves warm on. And it's the only thing keeping their homes warm in. And so I think valuing natural gas right now and its current functions in our homes doesn't also mean that we can't move to a decarbonized future where we're not using fracked gas in the future. It's going to take decades to really turn over and make those retrofits. And you think, if you have that in your house now, how soon are you going to be able to invest in pulling all of that stuff out? For most of us, we don't do major overhauls to our homes often, if ever. But let's not make the problem worse as we go forward. And I know that gas utilities are looking to grow their investments in renewable gas or hydrogen gas, because they see where we're going.
Renewable gas, we shouldn't get into that too much today, but from my understanding about that, that's really a canard. It's kind of like clean coal.
No. So I want to distinguish between, you know, renewable gas from greenhouse gas sources that I know people have an issue with versus like a cleaner renewable gas, like a clean hydrogen, which is, you know, not combusted or created through petroleum-based systems, but are done through clean hydrogen systems or hydro, for example, as a byproduct. There's ways to do it. It'll be more expensive until it's scaled, but we don't need to expand methane capture, for example, as renewable gas. Although capturing that stuff and reusing it has a purpose. It's better than letting it be released into the atmosphere. So anyway, yes, I agree with you. But that's also probably deeper into the weeds than most of your listeners are ready for us to go right now.
Another thing that I've been thinking about coming out of having this power outage and thinking about what's going on in Texas right now, I think about the need to have locally produced and locally distributed power, like really moving away from these massive grids. Is this an area that you've thought much about? Because it seems to me one of the big lessons from all the shutdown here in Oregon, here it was a case of power lines being knocked out by trees. So there seem to be two issues. And one is, why are our power lines in the sky as opposed to being underground? And the second one is, if we're going to be moving towards renewables, they're easily built in as neighborhood facilities as opposed to being built way far away and having to have a lot of transmission lines.
So the reason why we don't have undergrounded power lines is because most of our homes were built for a different climate era. And our systems, I mean, we're seeing this across the nation. All of our systems, our roads, our bridges, our energy, our water, were built for different weather events. To now go back and bury all those lines would be astronomically expensive. It's not, because you think about having to dig up roads and who pays for that and undergrounding all of that. That's also not going to solve burst water pipes issues in areas that are seeing cold snaps like they've never seen before. And we're certainly not going to, for example, begin to regulate private property trees and how people should or should not be maintaining them, especially with old trees. Because let's recognize most people don't have the money to hire an arborist every year to come out and assess their trees and to cut down branches. And also, you can't even plan for 2 inches of ice on your tree, right? Trees were continuing to fall and snap in our neighborhood up and until Monday night as things melted unexpectedly. I was out for a walk and heard one massive tree go down behind my neighbor's house. So I think going forward, it's going to be a matter of, where do we spend our money? What is the best way we can prepare for the myriad of different extreme weather events that will come with increasing frequency, and how do we make our system more resilient for people? I think it's infeasible right now to put a battery in everybody's house, but certainly moving to a broader electric car adoption will give people a place to charge phones and other equipment in the event of brief power outages. And in some areas in the country, having an electric grid network is used as a battery to store energy to then help get through short power outages for the utility. There will be a lot of lessons coming out of this. I think having energy resiliency backup at our emergency locations is essential, and Oregon has already been well on the way to do that. But it's just interesting. How do we do microgrids? How do we create more resiliency within the system? But also, how do we do it in a way that is going to be affordable? And we know that so many Oregonians already pay a large amount of their household's budget on energy, and we really can't burden them more.
When I think about having regional power as opposed to the massive national power grids that we have, I wonder, how expensive would it be to put up a bunch of small wind generators and solar panels in scattered in neighborhoods, let's say in Portland, and we'd maybe have 25 different neighborhood energy centers. And then the amount of wiring you need to get from those centers, but getting that out, you wouldn't have this kind of cascading effect that we had with all the outages. And then I think about in Texas with the kind of grid they have, which is might not be on the part of the on the national grid, but it's certainly a statewide grid. And the way it was going down was an indication of just all the vulnerabilities of that system. So I wondered, can you envision that we could do distributed power in a way that would be affordable and maybe not so daunting to do in the near future?
Not in the way that you've described it in the near future, because of the way that we all put a significant demand on the system all at once in the morning and in the evenings. I mean, most people are washing their dishes and doing laundry when they get home, which is when, and the sun goes down, and when wind kicks up around dusk, but may not be available in the evening. So I think, though it hasn't risen to national attention, even over the last 4 years, there continues to be innovation around battery storage or other ways to store energy to help us get through the lower ends of the, I think what experts call the duck curve, where demand is highest during the day, drops off at night, and yet we still need to have power for these kind of cold snaps. I don't know. I'm not enough an expert to know if we can completely turn into microgrids through just wind and solar, and what kind of cost impacts that would have in deconstructing our current system and rebuilding it anew. But certainly there needs to be a balance. I mean, the nation is facing, when I was looking at it last year, $1.3 trillion that needs to be invested over the next decade in upgrading transmission lines. And so we are presented with a choice. Do we want to keep the system as it currently works? Is that working for us? Or as we are making new investments, do we want to look at things differently?
Well, I think if Elon Musk spent less time trying to get to Mars and spent more time developing the batteries, which he's had a very large impact on really expanding the capacity of batteries, it would really help. I think battery development would really make a huge difference.
Well, I also think that there's plenty of innovation happening within the government, probably over the last couple of years, or with partners within the government. Elon Musk just gets more attention because he tweets more frequently. But for example, I went to a facility outside Denver, to one of the National Energy Renewable Labs, where they're testing out new technology. And they are working on new ways to create batteries that don't use minerals extracted from the Congo, because that's going to be a source material problem. They were also working on developing paint on solar panels, roll on solar panels that could be put on existing windows of commercial buildings and skyscrapers and help capture energy that way. There's such cool stuff going on out there. It gives me hope. It's just keeping the attention of policymakers.
Well, we'll get to that in a little bit. Meanwhile, I want people to know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Oregon State Representative Karen Power, who represents District 41, about the issues that we are facing in this very strange time we're living in, which we're focusing right now on climate. We're going to also be talking a little bit coming up now about COVID and also about taking care of our kids. One last thing about this, facing the reality that things are not going to be in the future the way we expected them to be. A number of years ago, doing this first documentary I did about climate change, and I was talking with this ecologist who was out in Nowaco, Washington. And one day I went out to see her, and she showed me this paper called The End of Stationarity. And it was written by a bunch of engineers who were the only ones in the world who knew what stationarity meant, which basically was stationarity is the reality that you can predict the future based on the past. And it was something that they were concerned about in terms of building infrastructure. So this was back in 2010, and they were talking about their concerns about big infrastructure, particularly like dams and bridges, that might not be able to withstand future impacts of climate if they were built from the specs from the past. And it's something that I started thinking about and didn't hear a lot of people talking about until recently. And now, of course, it's a big subject in Texas, but it's a subject all around the country. I'm wondering, are these discussions that you're having in the legislature, and is this news to people, or have people been realizing that this is a problem we really should have been facing many years ago?
In the middle of COVID this year, maybe, you know, if you wanted to transition to that or childcare next, we can talk about how those things are all interrelated with climate. It has been such a year that extreme weather events and climate change has not been front page news relentlessly the way I think it was just a couple of years ago. But I think the broader public is aware of the way that things are changing. And yet, you know, we as policymakers are really good at fixing the thing that is right before us. Creating longer term, longer range plans is up to government agencies and the departments that sort of run the background of providing the essential services in our daily lives. At the federal level, those agencies have been gutted, and longtime experts have left because of, I think, the politicization of climate, when so many good people working there for ages are just trying to help our nation become more resilient before this becomes an absolute immediate crisis in all ways and shapes of our lives. I want to call folks' attention to so many things that happen that never make the news, rulemaking processes, citizen-led work. And so our Department of Land Conservation and Development has been working to convene agencies to look at adaptation and mitigation for the last several years. They have an update, I think, that came out either last year or the year before. For those who are ready to pick up a light 600 pages or so of reading, our Department of Energy at the state level came out with a great biennial energy analysis. There's little summaries if folks are just looking to get an overview of options here. But it was a great treatise on what does our system look like now? How do we move forward? What are our sort of near-term options and longer-term options, depending on what kind of policy decisions you want to make? So the, you know, we've been fortunate here as a state to have really great, very bright people working for us. It's just a matter of executing locally, statewide, and nationally on the hard decisions we have to make. This is not going to be free, but it's going to get more expensive the longer we wait.
Are you heartened at all that we have a new administration? I mean, I just personally, every morning I wake up and I think that Joe Biden is president. It's like now we can start thinking about things in reality. We're back to a reality-based world. But do you have hope that the signals that are going to be coming from Washington, D.C. now, not just the signals, but the actual efforts, are going to make sense and are going to actually help us out of this problem?
Yeah, I think when we look at the last 10 years of policy debates, it's been, how do we regulate this? Or how do we make entities pay, right? We've been very focused on polluter pays principles. And I think from what I have seen out of the administration, they understand holding companies and folks accountable for their impact is important. But also, if we don't start moving on this right now at scale, it's not going to matter. The next 4 to 15 years of policy debates around whether this particular policy is going to solve global climate change is going to be too late, because we're already a little too late. So my understanding of their approach is to begin to just spend and direct, and putting back into place things that were previous there, like vehicle emission standards, incentivizing the build out of electric vehicle charging stations, and deploying money that is going to put people back to work and help us to catch up on all of the work we should have been doing, frankly, over the last 30 years.
Now, is that going to help Oregon do the same thing?
Yes. You know, a lot of the work that Congressman DeFazio has been leading around transportation, I think, also acknowledges that transportation is an essential need for most people and needs to be climate resilient. We can't just fix things the way that we used to when, for example, sections of 101 keep on washing out and stranding people in those areas. I think it still remains to be seen what their precise plan is. But, you know, I'm excited to have folks who recognize climate change is real in charge. And it really is a breath of fresh air.
Well, let's move on to COVID. And I think one of the first things that comes to my mind as a senior citizen around COVID and climate is I read a report yesterday that there was some problems with getting these vaccines that were supposed to be coming from, I believe, Memphis, which is in a big freeze, second only to Texas. And so the doses had not arrived in Oregon. And one of the groups that was going to be affected were senior citizens. And sure enough, two of my friends who had scheduled to get their shots today, and today, by the way, is not when you're listening to the show, but it's the 19th of February. So they were called yesterday and were told that the shots didn't come in and they have to wait till next week. So there's two things here. I'm very interested in talking about how Oregon is finally rolling out the COVID vaccine, which seems to be a little bit late. But then the fact that there's this incredible freeze going on in the center of the country where the shots are coming from is also affecting our ability to provide vaccines to all these vulnerable populations that really are waiting for their shots.
And I would layer on top of that the state-by-state decision-making. has led to a patchwork of different prioritizations, different points of access that has left people really frustrated. Most of us know people outside of our own states. And I think seeing my older family members have friends in other states who have already gotten access, but they don't, or vice versa, is deeply frustrating to people. I think it's good for us to remember that a little more than just a month ago, we all thought there was a second reserve of shots available that the federal government had been holding back, and those would be forthcoming. The deployment and disorganization around supply caught all of the states off guard. And so, you know, it has been so frustrating, I know. I can't imagine being signed up and getting ready, you know, emotionally and physically to go get your shot and have that sense of being able to begin to put this chapter behind you and then have that pushed out even further from you. And how demoralizing that must be. We as legislators hear from all of our constituents on this issue. And then yet I think it's important for us to acknowledge that we can ask questions, we can follow up, but it's been the executives from the top down to each of the states in charge of rollouts. In some ways, they are doing their best. They're doing the best they can. We each as states have had our strengths and weaknesses, and it really continues to be an unprecedented situation. I'm hopeful that we get supply to the degree where people can make plans and begin to plan for living their life differently than they do right now, knowing that they're going to be able to get their shot, knowing that their friends who may be 5 or 10 years younger than them are going to get their shot soon. And there will be a day coming this year where we can socialize again and see each other. Because I think that if I can distill the feedback I've gotten and the frustration and I'll say anger I've gotten from constituents, people are lonely and they're ready to be done being lonely. And the prospect of not knowing when that is going to come, I think is incredibly frustrating for people. And I understand that.
Well, I had this flash several times when we were trying to navigate the state system to get a reservation, to get a shot at the convention center. And actually, then we found out that our local pharmacy is going to be doing shots. And so we figured out, actually, my partner was the one who figured out how to navigate that. And she got an appointment, and this other friend of ours who's her age also got an appointment. But it was reminding me of the rollout of Obamacare in Oregon several years ago. And I was actually just 3 months away from being able to qualify for Medicare. So I was trying to get onto Obamacare. And it was a nightmare. We started calling, I think it was called Care Oregon. We were calling it We Don't Care Oregon. You'd be on the phone for 6 hours waiting on hold, and then you get bounced off. And it took forever. It took me like 6 weeks to actually get on. So I feel like there's been a history of the Oregon Health Department really failing. And I think in the case of Obamacare, it was particular problems endemic to the Oregon Health Department at that time. But it still feels like we're not getting the information from Oregon Health Authority that we want to get. And do you have any idea why that is?
I don't. I mean, we find out when they make decisions about how to disperse information to the public, you know, the chat function that they created at the bottom of the website where people went to the location to sign up. And I mean, my mom would never know how to use that. She doesn't live here in Oregon, but having individual counties have ways to get people signed up, then having people be able to sign up through OHA, not knowing how to answer questions through the chat function that were not particularly intuitive for folks who may not especially be tech savvy. And then on top of that, having 211 as an other way to sign up, well, that just sets up a system where the people who do know how to work the system or how to call in at the same time, for example, you're trying to sign up on OHA, it's not a fair playing field. Let's just say that. And I appreciate the simplicity of the questions that OHA is trying to set up through that chat function, but I can tell you, like, my staff and I screenshotted it just so we could circle it on the website and send it out to people who are emailing us not able to understand the website.
When we did it through the pharmacy and we did it through Health Mart, it was much simpler. I was actually helping this friend of mine who still didn't have power. So I was her scribe, basically, through my internet that was working. And we went through the questions and it was very easy. Unfortunately, we got to the end and there was no appointments available. But then she got one later on. It's still very strange. I mean, I haven't figured out why the appointments come and why they disappear. But it seems to me that the it's much easier for people to navigate the pharmacy sites than it is to navigate the state sites. And I don't know if you have any sense about why that is.
Probably because pharmacies are used to having people sign up for shots, right? So many people get their flu shots at the local pharmacy or the grocery store when they have clinics and things set up. And I think many states are being conservative about supply and running them through major hospital systems who presumably would have the ability to schedule people and push out vaccines. Maybe that makes sense from a supply chain management issue, but it's not how most people access shots. And if you look at the back end, I mean, I hope there's assessment after this. The cost of having a hospital care worker provide a shot versus a pharmacy technician, those are not the same costs. Somewhere in our healthcare system, that is going to be a cost that people will end up paying. And that was one of the first things that jumped out at me. But we have, I'll redirect since I am not a healthcare clinician. I am thrilled to have two new legislative colleagues, Representative Lisa Reynolds, who's a pediatrician, and both doctors, obviously, Maxine Dexter, who's chair of the new healthcare subcommittee on COVID-19 response. And I'd commend to you all, if you're interested in watching the hearings, those are available online and streaming. And I am very, very lucky to have incredibly competent women at the front lines of healthcare, especially with Dr. Dexter leading this committee and helping to improve our state's response.
Well, it's always good to have doctors working in the government. I mean, I think some of the best legislators over the years have been doctors. I think besides lawyers, it's really good to have doctors.
Especially when you're in the middle of a pandemic and you have a healthcare system.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cambridge Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And we're talking today with Oregon State Representative Karen Power, who represents District 41. And now we're going to talk about the third crisis we're facing right now in this time of pandemic, power outages, the end of democracy if we don't watch our steps. The other big issue, of course, is the concerns of children. And Karen, as a mother of two young children, I guess this really resonates for you. So let's talk about what prospects you see for how the legislature in Oregon can address the needs of children in this session.
So I am incredibly excited to be the chair of the reconstituted Early Childhood Committee. It's a committee that existed a couple years ago, was eliminated, and we brought it back this year because early childhood needs and care needs are different than the K-12 system. Just to kind of level set for readers, somewhere around 75% of our child care provider system in Oregon is financed through private family pays. So those are what we pay to send our kids to school every day. Contrast that with our K-12 system, where we all pay a little bit in property taxes and we have general fund flowing to that program. I can't imagine the outcry if all of a sudden the pandemic was over and your local elementary school closed. People would be up in arms. And yet this is what's happening on a provider by provider basis for our early childhood care providers. So this upcoming session, you know, our work around early childhood is really driven by a couple of things. The pandemic has exposed how the privatization of early learning doesn't work for families, doesn't work for providers, provides poverty wages for most childcare workers. We don't pay people what they're worth, and yet most families are paying more than they would for college to send their kids to preschool.
Sorry.
At the same time, our state agencies have had a couple different functions in different locations. And so our major work this year is reforming our agency structures so they better center families and providers and serve them better. We have an early learning division, for example, that regulates providers, does a lot of the studies around childcare, provides contracted baby slots, and DHS, on the other hand, that runs subsidy programs. So we need better alignment between those. And we'll have a hearing on Monday on two bills to tackle that. But I think, and as we're running out of time, here's really what keeps me up at night. Women are dropping out of the workforce at an alarming rate. I was speaking with Treasurer Reed, and we're at a 33-year low for women's participation in the workforce. Some 37,000 women in Oregon have dropped out of work. And we know a lot of that is because they are the ones shouldering the care for kids during the pandemic, or whose work is incompatible with kids' distance learning, or maybe they can't afford to send their kids to childcare anymore. And so we're doing major reform efforts to run our systems better, but I am particularly excited at what the Biden administration has been proposing to support almost all families who have little kids, because our birth rates are beginning to fall significantly because it's incredibly expensive and exhausting to have a kid in the middle of the pandemic. Kids are our future. We're not serving them well before the pandemic, and we need to serve them a whole heck of a lot better and their families coming out of it.
So what are your hopes for how to approach this?
In the near term, we begin to fix our agency structures so that people are in the same lanes, that we use our purchasing power through subsidies better or more efficiently for families. And then more broadly, states can't fix this alone. We really need significant federal investment to help make affordable our childcare more affordable. Some of the proposals out there are paying families a couple hundred bucks a month for kids under the age of six, beginning to make a plan for universal preschool. And I'm excited by any and all of these because we begin to actually eliminate childhood poverty. I mean, it's astonishing to me. It's crazy that it took a pandemic for parents to be and families to be seen. But I know everybody's at their breaking point in the pandemic, trying to keep their kids healthy, housed, fed, socio-emotionally healthy through all of this, while they're still struggling for work, looking for work, worried about whether their job's going to come back afterwards. And anyway, I want folks to know they've got a bunch of working parents in the legislature now fighting for them.
Well, I've thought a lot about how this pandemic has brought to mass attention issues that were sort of buried a lot before. Primary one is racial justice or racial injustice. And we saw that in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, as well as I think we're hearing and noticing and remarking about the importance of essential workers and looking at who the essential workers are and beginning to appreciate our grocery workers and childcare workers and people who were just kind of overlooked and taken for granted. I wonder if you see how this growing awareness as a result of the pandemic can break through after the pandemic is over and really change the way that we respond to all these different people in our culture.
Do you mean through a childcare lens or more broadly?
More broadly. At this point, I'm just thinking about how much we've shifted our attention to a much wider perspective, much wider array of people than we used to notice before.
Yes. And I think how we make policy and center voices and include them in helping to drive our policymaking needs to be very, very different moving forward. The fact of the matter is, you know, it costs a lot to run for office. It's a huge toll on your family. And it's inaccessible for many people who have immense skills and talent. I think Oregon had been well on its way to electing a greater diversity of life experiences, ages, racial backgrounds. But, you know, when you look at executive, Congress, and state legislatures, and who comprises those institutions, they are built from grassroots organizing or lack thereof. What happened in Georgia this year gave me immense hope because we're beginning to see the fruits of multi-year organizing, changing the people who get elected, who make decisions that are incredibly important for all of our lives. I think the hardest thing about the pandemic and being in the legislature is we don't get to meet each other the way that we would have in normal times. But I look to some of my new colleagues like Ricky Ruiz or Wins V. Campos and am just inspired that they have climbed to some of the highest levels of decision making in the state on behalf of deeply rooted communities that they've been a part of. And they're not even 30 yet. I mean, you think about the knowledge you gain from doing this job and how many years it takes to become really good at it. And the way that whether people stay in the legislature or not, or stay in local government or not, understanding how decisions are made and helping to make those decisions be made better on behalf of everyone will have benefits for all of us as a state.
Well, Karen, it's always good to talk to you. And I hope the next time we talk, maybe you'll be back in Salem again.
Yeah, me too. As my wife says, she was reading, you know, we're at the bottom of the well still. We can see the light, but we have to still keep on climbing. We're not all the way out yet, but COVID case counts are dropping. Medicine is better than it ever has been before for treatment. And I'm hoping maybe in another month or two, vaccine supply will be where it should have been. And we'll all be getting those appointments soon.
Well, thanks for being on Locus Focus, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Oregon State Representative Karen Power, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCPB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO, or renewing your membership if you already are a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk about social change in Appalachia with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute and Ted Boatner with the Ohio River Valley Institute. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with music by Sweet Honey in the Rock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
Listen more often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's bird when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's bird in the voice of the waters. Those who have died have never lived. The dead are not under the earth. They are in the rustling trees. They are in the groaning woods. They are in the crying grass. They are in the moaning rocks. The dead are not under the earth. So listen more often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things elemental beings. 'Tis the ancestors' breath. When the fire's voice is heard, 'tis the ancestors' breath. In the voice of the waters, those who have died have never left. The dead have a pact with the living. They are in the woman's breast. They are in the waiting child. They are with us in the home. They are with us in the crowd. The dead have a pact with the living. So listen more often to things than to themes. Listen more often to things than to themes. 'Tis the ancestors' breath. When the fire's voice is heard, 'tis the ancestors' breath. In the voice of the water, listen more often to things than to themes. Listen more often to things than to themes. To the ancestors, when the fire's voice is heard, when the ancestors' voice is heard, when the voice.